next two or three periods, we will be talking about organizing and writing the thesis. Now, much of this is in the area of practical help on the basis of the experience of others, and the bulk of it really is already in the material, and it'll be just a matter of calling your attention to it and calling a few highlights to your attention. And while in some instances you'll be asking someone else to type your thesis, nevertheless, you yourself should know the basic rules, if for no other reason than you'll be able to read with some understanding what the symbols and the abbreviations mean when you read other people's theses. So it isn't merely a matter of typing rules. In fact, when they are purely typing rules, we won't even consider them, because we'll assume that the basic typing rules are well known. Assuming now that we have all the notes gathered and are ready to make our first draft, and that's the one we talked about last time, is really a free draft. Let me say it before that actually is done. I should have said this before. Even now, when you are in the earlier stages, it's well to constantly read and reread your own notes, if for no other reason that they become a part of your thinking, part of your planning. That will help. A lot of the material then will be pre-digested for you and make it much simpler when you try to organize this thing in a logical way. In the rough draft, as I said last time, you will be primarily interested in getting the logical flow. And therefore, you will not write the first chapter nor the last chapter in your initial process. The first chapter may be actually one of the last chapters that you will write, for the reasons that we'll note later on. You may want to even start in a later chapter. Different chapters have different functions. Again, ignoring for the moment the first chapter, the second chapter, perhaps the third, will attempt to give the reader a setting. This is the known part, assuming that he knows much of it, reacquainting him with the setting, or if he doesn't know certain important elements of it, getting him to see that so that he will understand what your findings and what your report really is trying to say in the later chapters, so that there is a progression of thought from the known to the unknown. Since the purpose of that first draft is primarily to mobilize your material in a logical way, don't spend much time on the language, the English, the style. Don't even worry too much whether you've got such very important things as topical sentences. All of this very important material for a first real draft should not get in your way. Don't let the details become a stumbling block at this point. This will be hard enough. And once in a while you would like to spend a little time polishing, because it'll be sort of a relief to do, well, you can conscientiously say you're doing something to your thesis. It's just like, you know, when a man's got a job to do and it should take a couple hours and he dreads getting down to this business, and fortunately a friend comes along and says, let's have a committee meeting this afternoon. Well, then you can put it aside for a moment and, well, you're doing your duty. You're having a committee meeting of the congregation or wherever you are, and you can put this aside with less degree of guilt. You know, the same thing when you know you can get to a point and then laboriously write out the direct quotation out of your card. You're doing something, and that may salve your conscience. No, better keep at the job of producing. And this is admittedly a very difficult time. You're in labor. And like all birth pains, this is not something that you can shed at this moment. It's like you can't be half pregnant, I said the other day. You may have misgivings how you ever got into this condition, but you're in it. So just keep on producing. And get down to the job of writing. And then when you've got that whole chapter on paper, in a very crude way, after all, nobody else is going to see it but you, then go back to the polishing job of getting good paragraphs in it, getting a topical sentence organized, and the like. Breaking up the chapter into good divisions, especially if they're unusually long, you may even want to divide a chapter. Maybe provide here or there subheadings to make it simpler for reading. Watch as you begin to polish your objectivity. Are you remaining objective? Are your biases and opinion kept back? Remember, that's what the final test will be. How you have recorded your report. Watch whether you've made some of these roundhouse claims for yourself and then you're not able to substantiate it, you know, these broad generalizations. I just read an essay given recently at a conference where a man who should know better and probably does know better, I don't know why it's in there, but a statement something like this, I didn't think of memorizing or quoting it directly, but he mentioned the fact that we should accept or work on the principle that every part of the Bible is so clear that every layman should be able to understand it. If we don't want to accept this, then let's go back to the Roman concept where the church has to be the interpreter for the people. Well, you know, he was trying to defend the perspicuity of the scripture, which always is limited to the basic salvation gospel message and not to everything. And you can see where the most profound theologian can come up with a statement like that and say that every passage in the scripture is that clear. If he is, he's going to put a lot of people out of business, I suppose. But you may not be guilty of that particular generalization. What's your own? You have your own biases, and you'd like to, and you know, because of the weak spot, you may make it a little stronger. In a sermon, you may shout a little louder when the thing isn't too coherent. You don't do this in a thesis, and so you may want to get a little flowery. Watch that very, very carefully. Obviously, good composition is a prime law. Everything that you learned in composition writing. What's your transitional sentences? Avoid beginning paragraphs with however, or making the infinitive as a subject. And those of you who are pretty good in Latin, watch out that you don't have too many ablative absolutes. That's good Latin, but it's poor English. This is one of the diseases, I suppose, that creeps into some of our writing. We carry it over from other languages. This is no argument against foreign languages, but I mean, it's, as soon as you've got two tongues that you're working with, or three or four, you will have a tendency to bring in these peculiarities. Another very common one is to have an adjective with the antecedent in the previous paragraph, and that particular this. Or such, using these words as adjectives. This was indicated by. Now, what's this referred to? Now, in your own mind, it's very clear. But it's a new paragraph, and normally shouldn't have any, start out with pronouns. Now, I say normally. There are some questions, like when it's a he, and the only person you talked about in the previous paragraph was a person. There's no problem. But when you have these general adjectives, this matter, or this something, maybe I'm just a little autobiographical. That happens to be one of my major weaknesses. Maybe you're not prone to those. What's your Germanisms, of course? This is if you are addicted to ablative absolutes, I'm sure more of you are addicted to Germanisms. Or the use of a passive voice, which is always a weak voice. Now, sometimes that's what you want. But generally speaking, the active is what you want. Read it aloud for rhythm and cadence. This is often a good way of seeing, does it come through? Now remember, I'm not talking about that first draft, that rough one. As you begin to polish around. And this second draft is the first, is really the one that you are giving to your advisor in a time schedule that is mutually satisfactory. So much for general rules. Now let's talk about the thesis style itself, which is page 9 of the material in your booklet. When you talk about a thesis style, you are in the area somewhat of the arbitrary. In many cases, there are a number of good ways of doing it. But no school, it's a matter of survival of the fittest, frankly, no school ever says, well, all right, if they do it that way in Chicago or in Stanford, we'll let it go by here. Simply because you can make a good case for it. Most schools, as far as I know, all schools are very arbitrary. Okay, they do it that way in Stanford, this is the way we do it here. So that there's a uniform way of doing it, not for the sake of uniformity, but as I say, it's a matter of survival. Otherwise, a thesis secretary would really have to be, or whoever is looking at it, would have to be a master of all the different possibilities, and this is really an impossible task. And oftentimes when a person says, well, they do it this way at another university, he's usually eclectic. This is one he takes out of that university and another one out of another one. You can almost always find any good thing in some system. Although, surprisingly enough, there is much more uniformity among universities and the seminaries than is generally realized. The differences, of course, become apparent when you deal in departments. If you deal with an engineering school, obviously they are going to, because of certain kinds, certain forms, occur more frequently. They have adapted a detail which the English department would say, no, that's not good English. But for the sake of whatever it may be, brevity or convenience, there are these exceptions. So in a theological seminary. Obviously, we will, especially in exegesis. One of the firm rules is that you never have any abbreviations in the body of the text. Well, that would mean that when you have, like Exodus, the Bible passage, that would always have to be a footnote then. Well, if you have anywhere from 20 to 25 quotations on a page from the Bible, especially if you're dealing right in with all these exegetical problems, you'd have almost every page half footnote. Well, one of the exceptions is that in an exegetical paper, while you can't have any abbreviations in the text, you may have it in parentheses and simply EX period 5, whatever it happens to be, when you refer to the book of Exodus. That's done for convenience sake. A lit person would say that's bad, it isn't good. Well, he may only use two or three Bible passages in a whole thesis. Oh, none at all, presumably, in many cases. Well, these exceptions every school has to finally determine. And that's why the rules here are set, and there's always a reason for it, and it's much easier to work with, operate with a standard guide. Our major source, of course, is the well-known Chicago Style Manual, which is the sort of the Bible for most of these thesis jobs. And when we vary, it's only in the concession because we're dealing with theological subjects, which has its own area of emphasis. Now here, outline, here's the general format of a thesis. Page 9, the title page, blank page. We'll look at each one of these individually later on. acknowledgments, that's optional, you may not need it. Table of contents, list of tables is also optional. List of illustrations, an option. And then the text itself, and that's into three major sections. The introductory chapter, and it's not called introductory chapter, we're merely describing the chapter, it's called chapter one, or in rare instances, sometimes in a doctorate, it might go into chapter two, but it's very rare. Then the report, and then a summary chapter. The report, of course, is the thesis. And keep that in mind, it'll help you a lot with your grammar later on in terms of tenses. Remember, you are writing a report of a piece of research that has been completed. And so it's not a violation at all to indicate in the opening chapter already a summary of your conclusions. Not a mystery novel, so you wait until the last page to find out who done it. And the last chapter, of course, is a summary often of summaries. Then the appendix, or several of there are, and then the bibliography. Now let's look at the individual parts, and I think we can do this quite rapidly since all the basic items are here. Would you look at in the supplement in the back, pages A to C. The back part has been, we put letters rather than numbers so that nobody is confused and looks as these numbers as though they were part of the sample. And here you'll notice all the parts and the measurements given to you. It contains the full title, the designation of the school, the department, and the degree. A thesis presented to the faculty of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Department of Historical Theology, in partial fulfillment, because after all, you did something else besides that, of the requirements for the degree of Master of Sacred Theology. Then your name, and the date of the month of the convocation, not when you finish it, but you're getting your degree in May, then this is where you put down May 1967. And then approved by your advisor and reader. Doctorates, of course, you have three spaces because you have two readers. Now, in general, this is the format. I say in general because you may only have one line for your title and you may have more. You'll see it on page B as it is without the measuring devices in there. And C, with a slight variation, when you have a three-line title. The measuring is the only thing that's different. Then you are to provide a short title in many instances. If there are more than 36 typed spaces, that includes also the blank between the words, typed spaces in your title, then you must provide the registrars or the library, as the case may be, with your own short title, which you put on a special sheet of paper, heading simply short title, and the title will appear on, the reason a short title is because after all there are only so many spaces for the spine of the thesis, and if you have a long one, more than that, it can't stretch it, you know. And so you provide a short title. You don't want someone else to provide it because you're the one that's the best interpreter of what an adequate short title would be. And so the words will appear something like this, Spanish Missions, 1559-1784, semicolon, your name, the last name, Randoy, STM, 1960. And you put that in a loose sheet. That's provided for the registrar. The binder gets that. He puts that on the spine, and of course, it is not, does not become part of the thesis. 36 typed spaces. Next, pagination. As you know, there are two sets of pagination in every thesis. namely all the parts of the thesis which goes up to chapter 1, is one part of it. That's the part that you will write last, obviously, the index and so on. And because you're writing at last, you cannot number the pages in a regular sequence beginning with the title page, because chapter 1 begins with page 1, and that's the normal Arabic number, and on top of the page, and on those pages prior to chapter 1 are in lower case Roman letters on the bottom of the page. Now, immediately you have to bear in mind another rule, that you never let the page number appear at the beginning of a new section, like chapter 1, or the first page of table of contents, the first page of your dedication or acknowledgement, and obviously not on the title page. So while the title page is number 1, it does not appear on there. It could possibly be that the first 3 pages will not have any number on it, because one of them is the title page, another one is the table of contents, and only 1 page long. If it's 2 pages long, well then, for the first time, you'll have the Roman 3 appear, and so on. Is that clear? This is on the bottom of page 9, indicated. Oh, I forgot to mention the fact that the title page is followed by a blank page, and that's only for binding purposes, and is not therefore counted. It is the equivalent of the inside cover in terms of what happens to it. It's a page merely to help keep the material clean. That's all it is. It's purely utilitarian. Has no great esoteric value. Then comes the first section, acknowledgments, on page 10 now. We'll go through this quite rapidly. This page may be inserted, though it is not generally recommended. The acknowledgments for a thesis are given to people who have helped you over and above their duty. So when you don't acknowledge the help of your advisor. That's what he's there for. That's why he puts his name on the page. He's helped you. Unless he gave you some illegal help, and then you don't want to indicate it. The librarian who gives you a lot of help. You don't mention that. Because this is part of the school's job. That goes always, in every case. Now, it may be that a librarian of a foreign school, by that I mean a school other than your own, may have given you some important help or some important advice. This might be regarded legitimate. You don't even put down an acknowledgement of your wife who was very long-suffering or has typed half of it for you. That's also in line of her duty. So don't put that in. So that's why, in general, these acknowledgements are discouraged, because you don't have that many. And if you feel that you've got to invent a few just in order to fill in that page, forget about it. But maybe you have a debt to pay, and this is one way you're doing it. Table of contents. These are illustrated on pages D and E. D is a very short one. You have no subheading. This is the simplest one. Notice how it's not necessarily centered. It may be even slightly off-center from up to, top to bottom, so to speak. All caps, table of contents. And then on the left-hand side, the word chapter, the letter C is on the margin. And the periods after the numbers are lined up with the last letter of the word chapter. The periods are lined up so that you have it not this way,
this way, so it's
a rugged margin to the left, as you notice. Then you have your leaders to help the reader to find the exact page, which is normally not necessary for a small page, but it looks better if you do it. These are, of course, every other space. And on the right-hand column, you've got the word page. And again, the numbers are lined up with the letter E on the word page. Double space between chapters, heading. I think everything is there, it's quite clear. Look at page E, and there you have subheadings. Notice how they're lined up. And again, you don't memorize this at this point. When you have to make your table of contents, then you look at the rules and see what it says. And in rare cases, and I mean rare, you might have a subheading. And that rule is also listed for you, although I doubt whether anyone here would have that. Any questions? Then comes a list of tables and list of illustrations, if you have that, and most of you may not have that. You look at page F and you have a sample of it. Okay, now let's look at the body of the thesis itself. Eight and a half by 11 page. The center of this page is not 4 inches over. 4 and a half, that's not the center. But remember, your book is going to be bound, and you will lose, roughly speaking, a half inch. So the center of your page is at 4 inches from this side. And everything is measured from this side, 4 inches, when we talk about the center. And as a result, you start typing 1 inch around. Don't go beyond 1 inch the bottom. Column 1 inch here, 1 inch here, and 1.5 inches. In other words, 1 inch also if you ignore this half inch. So that when the book is bound, you have fairly centered job of 1 inch all around. The one exception, of course, is, which you well know, when you begin a new chapter or a new section like appendix, bibliography, and the like, then it's down 1.5 inches. If you want to see a sample of that, look at page G. Now, whether this is actually 1 inch, I don't know, on the right-hand side, because when you get a job printed, you know, they don't always center it the way it should be. This is what we had hoped. But it's lined up for you, so you know. And look at H, and you'll see how the number, number 23, which is this chapter 2, page 23, is one inch, should be, isn't, should be. 1 inch from the top. Again, this fell down a little bit in the printing, I just noticed it. And the 23 is on that 1 inch line. And then, of course, you double space it before you start writing. Notice, back again to G, there are 3 spaces between the chapter and the title, 3 spaces between the chapter title and the subheading, which is centered. Notice that in the Development Lutheran Parochial School, the title, chapter title, all caps. In the next one, it's only the important one. If you had a subheading, it would be only the letter, the words that are normally capitalized. Yes, sir.
This is rather minute, but I was wondering about it when I did
Well,
you simply put your roller 1 inch and let the type fall where it is. It's up or low. There's a big difference. So technically, of course, it should be the top of the letter should be 1 inch, the number rather.
But when you get into that, you're in fractions.
And obviously here, because height can't stretch, you may go over a letter. But generally speaking, you go the other way, that you don't add more than one or two letters here. And the same thing, sometimes you're in a dilemma. If you have a footnote particularly, and it's only one line, you're over. And it might be the one you've got around because you've got your prefix there. And if you drop the letter, you don't have the footnote. So type can't be stretched, so that's the way you have to do it. Now, there is an exception when you go to 2, 3, or 4 lines. And you can't simply cut it back too far. We'll get that in a moment. But generally speaking, you have that little leeway.
What helps often, if you do, look at page J. I have found this quite a help for typing. This guide sheet, which again is a little off-center here, not proper, but you can get what we do. To make this out of black ink or India ink, and just make this frame work, being on the right-hand side, an inch away, left-hand side, 1.5 inches away, an inch from the top, inch from the bottom. And then on the bottom, notice on the left-hand side, starting on the line, go up 1, 2, 3, 4 to 10. And on the right-hand side, beginning with with that one, which is on the frame, all the way down. And put this immediately after your top sheet so that it shows through a little bit. Not on the back of your carbon, by the way, but in front of the carbon. And do this in thin paper so that you're not taking away too much away from your carbon pressure. And then you'll have that as a sort of a gray line which will tell you you've got that many lines coming up yet. Now, chances you're not going to be worried with that, because your typist will probably take care of that. But there are some of you may be doing it yourself. Or on the right-hand side, you have a warning of how far you're going. And the middle line, that the one that is down the center on J, always tells you what the middle of the page is, if you have to go for a subheading somewhere down the bottom. And then you can measure 24 letters, all right, 12 one way, 12 the other. Just a little device, and may save you some time. Yes, sir.
About the center line, I have the impression that it was placed to the center of the typing space for the typing.
Mm-hmm.
Are you referring here to the left?
This is the full page. Now, you're talking about the guide sheet that I talked about now?
Yeah.
Well, the guide sheet would be then something like this. It'll be smaller, see?
Yes. But I refer to the center line.
No, I'm talking about the body. Yeah. And then you see you'll have your numbers here, every other one, double space here and single at 1, 2. Then you... This is what you can use.
I only need this center line, which you will trace there on.
Oh. Well, that's 4 inches from here.
So it's not really in the center of the timing.
It's in the center of the typing space. Oh, yes.
But shouldn't it then be a little bit less than 4 inches from?
Well, actually, this is 4 inches. This part is 3 inches. You already lost the page here. And this is 3 inches. So, yeah, that's 6, 7, and 8.5. 1.5 makes 8.5. This is where you're...
So there would be a coincidence anyway. Okay, I understand.
Yeah, that would be a coincidence with this imaginary. It's the same one as the imaginary line, yeah.
Sure.
But it's not the middle of the page in its total form. That's all I'm trying to get to. That it's always a little cockeyed.
F, page F will give you, and I don't want to Oh, did we already talk about that? Sorry. Number nine, illustrations, tables, and figures. Actually, it's on 12. I don't think I want to spend the time. I'd like to get through this as rapidly with you because this gets you'll forget half of it anyhow. All I am interested now is to call your attention to the fact it's there. And there's an index in the back, and you can refer to it. And we're not going to memorize these rules anyhow. Page 13. Unless you have a question, then we'll stop. Or if you get it by slow motion and hit you next time, ask for it then. Now, here's this 13. This is important. That first chapter, remember I mentioned, made reference twice this morning, or this afternoon, rather. Now, that first chapter has its own purpose and its own content. And here are eight different things that may be in it, all eight or a number of them at least. To begin with, a statement of the problem investigated or the purpose of the research. That should be in there. What's the problem? What are you trying to do? That's obvious, of course. Number two, a validation of the study which is to set forth the importance the problem has for the student. Why do you want this? What caused you, what prompted you to choose it? What's the reason for it? Now, this doesn't always mean that you have a whole paragraph on all of this stuff. Sometimes maybe only a sentence. Sometimes it may be several paragraphs, depending on your own needs. We don't worry about the size of this chapter. This chapter may be only 5 pages long, while all the rest are 20 and 30. It may be a very large one. They don't have to be all the same. Three, the definition or the limitation of the scope of the problem. You're not taking all of it. What are your limitations? How have you limited the problem so you can handle it? This section includes, where necessary, a definition of the terms and the assumptions upon which the study was predicated. So, if, for instance, the title may be The Study of Nomos in Pauline Theology. Well, now, what use of nomos? Every use, every way it's used? Law, principle, and so on? Maybe yes. Or, all of Paul's letters, which are you talking about? What are your assumptions, and the like? Then four, a brief overview of the organization of the thesis for the benefit of the reader. You're giving him, you have explained your problem, why you're going to do it, what you mean by your problem, now give him an overview of the whole thing. And where necessary, number five, the history of the problem or its present status. Have other people talked about it? Has this been already the concern of others? And then give references where a similar phase of the topic may have been treated. And this again is a maybe. Number six, it may be appropriate to give an overview of previous investigations made in the area treated by the problem. Because somebody might say, oh, for goodness sake, we've had theses and more theses on this topic. What's the guy doing now? Well, you want to show how your study is different from previous ones, or what prompted this out of previous ones. Then the major sources from which the data were taken, the method followed, and where necessary, a description of how the findings were used. And then many studies conclude the first chapter with a summary of the findings, so that the casual reader may, by perusing the first chapter, have a quick overview of the entire study. It's supposed to be a single package deal, so that a man who is interested, he's attracted by the title, he wants to know, doesn't want to read the whole thesis, he wants to know what's it all about, what conclusion did you come up to, and very likely after he's through with that, he'll look at your bibliography. That's the second most important thing, to see how deep did you draw the water. From what depth did you come up? And then if it's what he wants, then he's ready to read. You keep this in mind, that you're this is not a suspense job. You're not saying, well, we're not going to tell you what's coming up until you read the last chapter. No, you give him a picture. And the final chapter, for that reason, is more or less a summary section. And it may be, since if every chapter is a little summary, it can often be the case, not so much in historical papers, but in philosophical, theological, occasionally practical papers. You have a brief summary of what this chapter proved, And then the summary will be the summary of the summary. You may be repeating, listing them in a coherent way. And again, the last chapter may be a very, very short one. But in addition to what I've said, you will also have noticed that there were some questions that you couldn't explore. They came up in the course of the study. And now you throw out to the reader some ideas of subsequent studies which might arise out of your topic. This will be a tremendous help. And that's what you want to do when you're looking for assistance or a topic. Study other people's theses and see where they fought with some interesting sidelight, which now might become your most important study. Okay? Then the appendix.
Brief, the appendix is a catch-all. Everything that you feel the reader ought to have, either to substantiate or to illustrate what you came up with in the thesis itself. But you didn't put it in there because it would only get in the way. For instance, if you're making a survey, you're using some kind of an instrument to get information. Well, the reader is entitled to know, how did you gather your material? What questions did you ask? Because this gives the direction already. Well, that would be one appendix then. Just the instrument used. Another one may be a major illustration of the point, either by parallel or an amplification. Or the text itself. It may be that you are analyzing a very brief section, and it's not readily available to the reader, and so you supply him with the complete text in Appendix B, and so on. If there's more than one, then of course you list them Appendix A, B, C, and D, and if there is only one, you simply call it that, appendix. And each appendix is listed in the table of contents. Bibliography, that's the last thing, and is listed in the table of contents. The title, look at section or page I. Your bibliography, it may be divided into primary and secondary sources. It may be divided according to books, periodicals, pamphlets, interviews, any kind of divisions. There is no rule on that. This is something which you determine with your advisor, because every thesis will be governed by different rules. If, for instance, you're writing on a man's theology, then presumably it might be A is primary sources, or the works, well, they would be the primary sources. Generally speaking, primary and secondary sources is not a good division, except in this case where you're dealing with the man's works, or with the manuscripts involved. It's much better, generally speaking, to have to divide it into books, periodical literature, pamphlets, interviews, not all of those, as many as you want. Now, that's only if it's a large bibliography. If it's a short one of one or two pages, then no division is necessary. This is merely for the convenience of the reader. Notice, again, that these are the same ways you have them on your cards, presumably at least. And this is a very simple job if you've done your job well at the beginning. Only now they are listed in alphabetic order, and well, that's the way they were in the first place when you gather them. Any questions at this point? Yes, sir. They should. Every book that you have used, even though you do not quote it, used and got something out of it, I should quickly add, because the chances are you use a lot, they're no good. And then you only confuse the reader because they say, what in the world is this? He knows the book very well. What did he get out of that book, I wonder? Well, the answer is nothing. Well, if you didn't get anything out of it, I mean, didn't even deal with the subject, then forget about it. But even though you used it and took no quotation, the point is there that the other fellow may be acquainted with the one you omitted and is not acquainted with the one that you use more often because they practically were parallel. And he says, well, look, this guy didn't even use so-and-so. What's it for? He should have been acquainted with it. So you're not padding it when you put in books that you didn't quote. Because you're giving him a fairly, this is also, this is one of the most valuable parts of your job, a good bibliography. And therefore, you should put every tool that you've used on getting rich in life.